couple of decades ago, the French philosopher and art historian Georges Didi Huberman reflected on the nature of the discipline. He wrote, "The history of art often ignores that, by its very nature, it is confronted by analogous problems, by choices of knowledge, alternatives that entail loss, whichever option is chosen." The work of the art historian, indeed, is full of choices as we explore the multiplicity of meanings and functions of the objects we study and strive for historical specificity. But what we include and exclude from the conversations matters as well. On a larger scale, choices of knowledge have informed the particular histories of Western medieval and Byzantine art. For far too long, these histories have had divergent geographic and chronological frameworks, with select moments of dialogue between Byzantium and the West addressed in scholarship. As we know from survey textbooks and how this material is taught, at least in American institutions, the different established narratives of medieval art focus, on the one hand, the artistic production of Western and Central Europe, and if we're lucky, perhaps as far east as Bamberg or Krakow, and span temporally from the 3rd to the 13th centuries. The study of Byzantine art and architecture, in contrast, tends to focus on Constantinopolitan artistic developments and select regions in the Eastern Mediterranean and the Balkan Peninsula, but progresses temporally from the 4th century up until 1453, when the Byzantine Empire fell to the Ottoman Turks. The art, architecture, and visual culture of medieval Sicily, Serbia, Kievan Rus, Ethiopia, and Armenia, for example, that reveal stylistic links with Byzantium, often find a place in the grander narratives of Byzantine art. But the artistic production of these regions do so much more than just reveal something of now lost Byzantine prototypes. The question of what medieval, Byzantine, or the Middle Ages means in geographic and temporal terms within the field of art history remains open to discussion, as research continues to broaden, enhance, and also complicate the picture. In this regard, the art, architecture, and visual culture of Eastern Europe still needs to establish its footing on the map of art history and that of the medieval world. Indeed, what happens in Eastern Europe during the medieval period, and more specifically in the northern regions of the Balkans and the territories around the Carpathian Mountains, as well as further north, which developed at the intersection of the Latin, Greek, Slavic, and a little later also Islamic cultural spheres, remains to be fully explored. My approach to the study of the medieval artistic production of Eastern Europe takes into account the historical circumstances of the Balkans and the Carpathians between the 14th and 16th centuries, and the connections that extended between select regions and their neighbors that resulted in the visual and also semantic eclecticism so characteristic of the art, architecture, and visual culture of these Orthodox lands. Today, I take as a case study the artistic developments in the Principality of Moldavia, a territory that extends within the borders of northeastern modern Romania and the Republic of Moldova, and together with the principalities of Wallachia and Transylvania, form the country of modern Romania. In the decades after the fall of Constantinople in 1453, as the Ottoman Turks turned their attention toward other points of resistance, particularly in the Balkans and regions of the Carpathians, with the aim to reach eventually the gates of Rome, Moldavia emerged as a powerful principality along Europe's eastern frontier. Situated at the crossroads of Western European, Slavic, Byzantine, and Ottoman cultures, this Carpathian region took on a central role in the continuation and refashioning of diverse artistic traditions alongside local developments. This visual syncretism is most evident in the artistic and architectural projects of Stephen III and those of his illegitimate son and heir, Peter Radish. Today, I address the historical circumstances that contributed to the new visual forms in Moldavian art beginning in the second half of the 15th century, and also examine the developments in monastic church architecture in the region under the aegis of Stephen and Peter. These rulers, through their artistic patronage, self-consciously reflected upon the past glory of Byzantium and their contemporary situation, and put forth models that were further developed by patrons of princely and noble rank in the decades that followed their illustrious reigns. As part of this discussion, I consider some of the modes of artistic transfer that gave rise to the unprecedented visual forms of the Moldavian churches, as well as the princely aspiration in the context of which they took shape. Then I engage with the structuring of sacred space in the Moldavian context and consider how the image cycles were carefully calibrated to enhance and give visual expression to the specific purpose of the part of the building onto which they were painted. Finally, I turn briefly to historiographic matters pertaining to art historical scholarship on Eastern European topics, and the ways in which the study of the Moldavian corpus might begin to encourage a rethinking of existing geographic and temporal divides within the study of Western medieval and Byzantine art. During Stephen's long and prosperous reign, spanning almost half a century, Moldavia was consciously transformed into a bastion and buttress protector of the Christian faith. Between 1457 and 1487, Stephen engaged in an extensive project to fortify his principality at key sites, initially in anticipation of, and then in response to, the Ottoman incursions into his territory. He first built or rebuilt a royal court in every one of the main towns in Moldavia, thereby stimulating the local development of civic and economic life, as well as making a public demonstration of his control and resources. Then, Stephen strengthened the key fortresses in the north and west, and then the fortresses at Cetatea Alba in Chilia in the south, along the Black Sea coast. The Ottoman historian and chronicler Tursun Beg described Chilia Fortress, for example, as, quote, the lock to Moldavia. Once it was captured, he explained, the path to the principality and to other lands in the west can finally be unlocked. Under Stephen's leadership, the cleverly devised infrastructure of fortresses and fortified locales delineated the perimeter of the principality and ensured Moldavia's protection from all sides. The ecclesiastical foundations that Stephen built contributed to this project as well, transforming Moldavia, as described in contemporary sources, into a gate of Christianity. By the spring of 1487, Stephen's military initiatives and strategic planning allowed Moldavia to enter a period of relative political, military, and economic stability. This moment was marked by a peace agreement ratified between the principality and the Ottomans that ensured the protection and freedom of Stephen's realm in exchange for the annual tribute payment. It was also precisely at this time, after 3 decades of extensive civic and military building campaigns and numerous battles to ensure the safety of his domain, that Stephen turned his attention toward the building of churches that transformed the sacred landscape of Moldavia. One of the first churches that he built, a Pachauts monastery, he dedicated to the Holy Cross. The dedicatory inscription, written in Church Slavonic and set in a narrow register at the center of the west facade above the main entrance, reads, John Stephen Voivod, Prince of the Land of Moldavia, son of Bogdan Voivod, started building this edifice dedicated to the Holy Cross in the year 6995, according to the Byzantine calendar, in the month of June 13. Although modest in size, the church at Pachauts consists of a square pronaos with the entrance situated at the center of the west facade, a tricong naos with 2 lateral apses extending to the north and south, and a semicircular eastern apse used for the altar. This layout offers the early stages of the development of the tricong plan in Moldavian ecclesiastical architecture. The silhouette of this edifice is further accentuated by the slender tower over the naos that is supported by a unique vaulting system specific to Moldavian churches, built beginning in the second half of the 15th century. The support system of these domes comprises of a series of so-called oblique arches that consist of overlapping arches and pendentives, with the upper set at a 45-degree angle to the vertical. This design, which diminishes by almost a half the span of the naos below, resulting in a gradual leveling of the interior planes and a vertical launch of the entire building, offers an intricate visual scheme at the point of transition to the dome above and additional surfaces for painted decorations. Although the architecture of the church at Pachauts, as elsewhere in Eastern Europe, has often been explored in isolation from the mural decorations that adorn the walls of the building and the objects and furnishings that played key roles in rituals, recent work has revealed remarkable facets of the careful design and decoration of the church. For example, on special feast days, certain light effects have been observed in the interior of the church that reveal how sunlight was deployed within the building to unite architecture, images, and rituals, and to underscore theological and ideological statements. As such, the Church of Patriots could serve as a case study that, once fully examined and recorded, will offer the foundation for future analyses of how medieval churches in Moldavia and throughout the Byzantine Slavic cultural spheres were designed, taking into account architectural features, mural decorations, liturgical rituals, light effects, and the acoustics of the spaces, among other concrete and more ephemeral phenomena. And if you're interested in the subject, I recently translated a book from Romanian into English on that documents these light effects, and I have a forthcoming article in Gesta co-authored on the implications of these light phenomena at Patroots. The Church of Patroots was consecrated on September 14th, the Feast of the Holy Cross. And this day and the cult of the cross that it celebrates were important to Stephen. On the same day in 1472, so 15 years earlier, Stephen married his second wife, Maria Asanina Paleologina of Mangoup, whose visage only survives on this richly embroidered cover designed for her grave in Putna Monastery in Moldavia, the monastic church built to serve as Stephen's princely mausoleum. The union between Stephen and Maria of Mangoup set in motion an array of cultural, artistic, and ideological transformations for Moldavia and its ruler. For example, the year after his marriage to this Byzantine princess, Stephen gifted a tetraevangelion, or gospel book, to Humor Monastery in Moldavia, in which he appears ritually dressed and kneeling before an enthroned Virgin Mary with a Christ child on her lap. The lower right side of the page has been damaged, but likely displayed an image of Stephen's wife, Maria of Mangoup. The colophon, or dedicatory inscription of this manuscript, makes explicit Stephen's aspirations by calling him Tsar. Here, Stephen is no longer a lord or a prince, that is, gospodar, the epithet that he and all his predecessors had adopted from the formation of the principality in 1359 onward, but rather he is addressed as an emperor or Tsar in the Church Slavonic form. The title Tsar appears in other written sources from this period and oftentimes accompanies the characterization of the ruler as a titor or founder. This appellation designated Stephen as a protector of orthodoxy in his territory and beyond, and rendered him akin to the Byzantine emperors who first took on this special role. He became thus a titor of ecclesiastical sites in his own domain, but also of monasteries outside of Moldavia, and especially those on Mount Athos, the peninsula in Greece that emerged after the fall of Byzantium in 1453 as the final locus of Orthodox spirituality and religious practices in the Eastern Christian world. Stephen, of course, did not oversee the initial construction of the Athenite monastic communities, as most were built between the 10th and 11th centuries, but he served as their new founder and protector at a moment when the Bulgarian, Serbian, Muscovite, and Georgian rulers, among others, reduced or ended altogether their support of the Athenite monasteries. Through his gifts of liturgical books, metalwork, icons, and embroideries, as well as monetary support, Stephen nurtured and renewed symbolically the former glory of the Byzantine Empire. His efforts ensured his perpetual commemoration by the Athenite communities, but perhaps more importantly, and by extension, rendered Moldavia as a polity, an heir to Byzantine orthodoxy. Furthermore, Stephen's Athenite patronage and his marriage to Maria of Mangoup certainly had collateral effects of contributing to the promotion of significant forms of Byzantine spirituality and artistic practices in Moldavia. For example, Moldavian workshops and scriptoria began producing manuscripts and liturgical embroideries rooted in Byzantine techniques, styles, and patterns. The extant documentary and material evidence attest to the strong and ongoing contacts between Moldavia and Mount Athos during the critical period in Christian history, marked by the second half of the 15th century, under Stephen's direct patronage, a relationship that carried historical, ideological, cultural, and also artistic implications. Where Stephen built more than 47 churches, chapels, and monasteries during his extensive reign, It was under Peter's patronage that architectural forms were consolidated in individual buildings, and 17 of the older churches and newly built ones received mural cycles, both inside and outside. The pictorial cycles of these buildings, a sample of which is here on the screen, emulate predominantly Byzantine stylistic and iconographic patterns, and were designed to function in tandem with the interior murals and the architecture of the churches. My case study for the remainder of this talk is the Church of the Annunciation in Moldovica Monastery, begun in 1532 under Peter's patronage. This building offers the best preserved example of how church architecture and its decorations developed in Moldavia by the initial decades of the 16th century. The large central church in Moldovica was built first, and the surrounding buildings were then erected. These included the cells of the nuns, the living quarters of the abbess, the princely house, now serving as a museum, the treasury, and the refectory, or dining hall, with other rooms and cellars below. The remote location of Moldovica, the need for defense in time of need, and desire to set the monastic world apart from the rest explain in part the presence of massive rectilinear fortification walls and towers that surround and also dwarf the monastery. This is also the case at other sites across the Carpathians and the Balkans, with fortifications in various configurations, and that is rectilinear or circular or polygonal. Unlike Stephen's churches, the layout of Moldovica is more elaborate. The church, characteristic of Moldavian monastic architecture as it evolved by the initial decades of the 16th century, is built on a so-called elongated tricon plan that consists of an open barrel vaulted exonarthex at the west end, a domed rectangular pronaos with two large windows on each of the north and south walls, a burial chamber, also known as a grobnica, with a single small window facing south, and a tricon naos. Toward the east end of the church extends the chancel, separated from the naos by a later large iconostasis. It becomes clear from the layout, architectural features, and furnishings that the interior of the church comprises of a longitudinal progression of spaces of different dimensions and serving different functions that grow progressively darker as one approaches the altar. Moreover, as the faithful progress through the exonarthex, pronaos, and burial chamber, they are mentally primed for their eventual passage into the naos. Although the single central entryways leading from one space to the next guide and control the physical progression through this church, the brightly colored mural cycles create a dramatic effect and further inflect visually this passage. The mural cycles are perhaps some of the most striking visual features of these Moldavian churches from the early 16th century. Executed by local and traveling artists, these image programs display Christological, Mariological, and hagiographical stories, interspersed with monumental images of historical and apocalyptic scenes, as well as full-length depictions of saintly figures and angels. Moreover, the image is carefully conceived in relation to the architecture of the building and the various functions of their distinctive spaces. Although fragments of extensive mural cycles survive on the exteriors of medieval Orthodox churches from the Byzantine and Slavic cultural spheres, some examples here on the screen, the Moldavian corpus is the only extant example that reinterprets and amplifies in striking ways this phenomenon, revealing how Byzantine artistic traditions of church building and decoration were continued, but also transformed in a new context after the events of 1453. The cool and relatively dry climate of the Carpathians and the remote locations of the churches may explain the extraordinary degree of preservation of their exterior frescoes. So, what do these images show in the Moldavian context? The extensive image cycles set in multiple registers on the interior walls of the pronaos and burial chamber received scenes from the Menologium, the text describing the religious feasts and martyrdoms of Orthodox saints corresponding to each day of the year. Each register shows saints celebrated in a particular month. Thus, the images wrap clockwise around the space of the pronaos and also that of the burial chamber from top to bottom, visualizing a passage of earthly time on the inner walls of the church. Moreover, reflecting Byzantine traditions of church decoration, the interior of the naos received scenes from the life of Christ and the Virgin, representations of full-length figures of military saints, and a votive painting that shows the patron, in this instance Peter Radish and members of his immediate family, presenting a model of the church to Christ enthroned via the intercessory role of the Virgin Mary, to whom the church is dedicated. Churches dedicated to St. George, for example, have St. George serving in this intercessory role. The height of the churches also allow for the inclusion of additional religious scenes, such as Christ's miracles, which appeared frequently in Serbian monumental mural cycles. This suggests that the conception of the Moldavian frescoes may have come about both through direct Byzantine models and others mediated through regions of the Balkans, such as Serbia, Bulgaria, North Macedonia, with which Moldavia established connections, especially through the Orthodox Church. Among the scenes painted on the exterior of the Moldavian churches, Christological and Mariological iconographies predominate. For example, the south wall of the burial chamber repeatedly received a monumental scene of the Tree of Jesse. This image type traces the genealogy of Christ, and in particular his human lineage, through Jesse, his son David, the kings of the Old Testament, and then finally through the Virgin. The Moldavian renditions of this image type also display narrative vignettes of prophetic moments from the Old Testament and full-length depictions of Greek philosophers, such as Plato and Aristotle, whose texts were read to contain allusions to the coming of Christ. As such, these elaborate representations of the Tree of Jesse were both genealogical and prophetic in content. And they were intended to highlight first and foremost the notion of lineage, that of Christ in the painted representation, and that of the prince buried in the space extending beyond the painted exterior. The Moldavian iconographic cycles, like the Tree of Jesse images, were likely conceived using working drawings, also known as antivola, and subsequently adapted to the desires of the patron and the monastic and lay communities for which they were designed and executed. One of the largest known antivolon, discovered in the archives of Dionysus Monastery on Mount Athos, shows the vertical and horizontal arrangement of individual scenes that make up the Tree of Jesse image. Hastily sketched and with exhaustive inscriptions, this drawing may have served as a design for a major work, or perhaps an effort to transfer the image from one location to another. Such antivola reveal some of the working methods of Byzantine and post-Byzantine artists for monumental paintings and also icons. They also attest to the collective process of art making in the later Byzantine period and in the centuries that followed the events of 1453, as well as the processes of transmission of iconographic variants from disparate regions that ensure the transfer of ideas among artists and successive generations of painters. And we know of one artist in particular, known to have worked at Peter's court in Moldavia. He was a certain George from Trikala in Greece, who upon his death in 1530 was honored with burial in a local church. In addition to the Tree of Jesse, the exterior south wall of the church in Moldovica, as in other examples, shows the Akathistos hymn, as the oldest performed hymn dedicated to the Virgin Mary sung in the Eastern Orthodox Church. The Akathistos was often represented in 24 scenes that stand for its 24 stanzas. Like the hymn, the murals of the Akathistos celebrate the important events in the life of the Virgin, praising her role in the Incarnation, Redemption, and their mysteries. The Akathistos eventually evolved into a war hymn believed to bring divine protection to the Byzantine capital during moments of struggle and by extension to the entire empire. During the later Palaiologan era, and in particular after the fall of the Byzantine Empire, the representations of the Akathistos acquired historical dimensions and came to incorporate scenes depicting the Siege of Constantinople that show the Byzantine capital saved through divine interventions. The mural of the Siege of Moldovica, as I have shown, references a number of historical moments, in particular the triumphant victories of the Imperium during the sieges of 626 by the Avars and the Persians, 717-18 by the Arabs, and 860 by the Rus. The inclusion of contemporary artillery presents an anachronism that brings the relevance of these earlier victories into the present. In light of the conquest of Constantinople in 1453 and the ongoing Ottoman threat in regions of the Balkans and the Carpathians, the image seems to hold out assurance that divine aid is forthcoming. Indeed, in drawing on older Byzantine sources, this powerful, multi-layered story of divine aid in the fight against non-Christian enemies functioned as a pictorial commentary on the continuing Ottoman threat against Moldavia's independence, political stability, and religious identity. We can talk more about this image in the discussion. In contrast to the predominantly narrative mode of representation characteristic of the majority of the interior and exterior paintings, the exterior of the naos shows images in a more iconic mode. Here, around the trichonic space, five registers display figures arranged in a hierarchical fashion, beginning with monks and hermits at the bottom, followed by martyrs, apostles, prophets, and angels. These figures are shown full length and directing their attention toward the east, as if partaking in a procession around the building that culminates at the axis of the altar window, where Eucharistic imagery abounds. The kinds of exterior images found in the Moldavian churches would have certainly welcomed the circumambulation of the monuments in the context of certain liturgical celebrations, such as those that occur in modern times during the Easter celebrations, for example. Scholars have argued that exterior encircling inscriptions and images on Greek and Armenian churches function in the context of ritual performances. Likewise, the Moldavian exterior murals should be viewed as part of the wider medieval phenomenon of interactions with inscribed structures that encouraged various audiences to walk around them. Before entering the pronaos of the church in Moldovica, the west facade displays scenes from Genesis, interspersed as revealed through the narrow arched openings of the exonarthex, with moments from the Last Judgment painted on the entire eastern wall of this space. And I'm showing you the example from Voronezh here to show you what this monumental scene of the Last Judgment looks like. The Church of Voronezh doesn't lack an exonarthex, so you can see the scene in its entirety. But here it is juxtaposed to the openings of the exterior. On one level, the juxtaposition of scenes from Genesis and the Last Judgment would have prompted a scriptural awareness of what came at the beginning and what will be at the end of times. On another level, this visual dialogue conflated temporalities on a single visual plane, stressing existence in time and serving as an appropriate marker for the beginning of the path to salvation, that is, through the church proper. As such, the open exonarthex, as evident in Moldovica and elsewhere, provided a space of transition between the natural world and the sacred space of the church, that in turn was further charged visually and spatially. Through the distinctive architecture, the particular choice and placement of the image cycles, their iconographies, and the conflation of temporalities within individual images and among groups of scenes, the Moldavian monastic churches of the early 16th century in particular continually stimulated the faithful. As they progressed physically around the church and from the outside to the inside of the edifice, along a carefully structured and defined horizontal axis leading toward the altar, and spiritually along a vertical axis once within the naos, the faithful were encouraged to approach the altar and stand under the great pantocrator in the dome in the right spiritual mindset for the celebrations of the divine liturgy. Although built and decorated so as to suit the needs of the Orthodox faith and its celebrations, the church in Moldovica, as elsewhere in Moldavia, also displays markedly Gothic features. For one thing, the mode of construction of the churches, using mainly quarried stone, emulates the building techniques found in Western Gothic civic and religious structures. The subdivisions of the roofs, with steep slopes and large, smooth eaves following up the undulating lines of the apses, and the three-tier buttresses on the exterior, find visual parallels in Gothic buildings, such as the Saxon churches from neighboring Transylvania and the Catholic churches in nearby Hungary. Moreover, the door and window framings and the window tracery also derive from Gothic models. Variants of the Spitzbogenportal and the Schulterbogenportal appear at the thresholds, and the large windows of the pronaos display two lancets with trefoil cusps supporting a quatrefoil oculus. Although little information survives about the masons who worked on the Moldavian churches, certain stonecutters we know were trained in Transylvanian workshops, that generally followed East Central European Gothic building practices and designs. And one figure, in particular, a certain John the Mason from Bistrica, we know he was summoned to Peter's court to work on his ecclesiastical projects, especially the Church of St. Demetrius in Suceava, begun in 1534. As such, architectural ideas would have circulated through workshop practices. Architectural drawings of Gothic features were regularly exchanged in medieval lodges of stonemasons and architects, informing practices of building construction across Europe. In my opinion, the Gothic forms present on the Moldavian churches from this period find an intriguing parallel in the ways in which classical elements were introduced to enhance the exteriors of Muscovite churches of the same time. For example, Tsar Ivan III summoned in 1474 the Italian military architect Aristotel Fioravanti to work on the walls of the Kremlin. While in Moscow, Fioravanti also ended up working on the Cathedral of the Dormition in the Kremlin, consecrated in 1479 and hailed as the first work of the Renaissance in Moscow. The register of blind rounded arcades, the engaged columns, and the subdivision of the facades were first introduced here. Italian forms and Muscovite buildings, however, functioned in an alien idiom. The painting tradition was not affected at all by Italian conventions, and architecturally, classical forms were articulated only as part of the exterior decoration of the Cathedral of the Dormition and other later buildings. In both the Moldavian and the Muscovite churches, what we could call foreign elements, that is, Gothic and classical forms respectively, appear in decorative features that do not affect or transform the prescribed Byzantine, that is Orthodox, structure and functions of the churches. For Moldavia, a pragmatic explanation is offered by workshop practices in the region and the presence of stonecutters from among Transylvanian Saxons to the east of the Carpathians. Another hypothesis points to the symbolic purchase of the Gothic elements. The variety of Gothic features on the Orthodox Moldavian churches could be interpreted as a symbolic alignment of Moldavia with the Christian world of Western Europe, for which the Gothic at that time signaled the Christian form par excellence. The distinguished architecture and iconographic programs of the Moldavian churches were certainly designed to express complex social and religious politics, as well as elucidate local processes of image translations, the transfer of artistic ideas, and particular dynamics of cultural contact in a region that developed at the crossroads of different traditions. Relative to other models, what these buildings offer is neither a direct synthesis nor a form of hybridity, since a hybrid is, in the most straightforward of definitions, implies two purities that are mingled to produce something new, and that is not the case with these examples. In a more nuanced sense, a hybrid is the sign of an attempt to reconcile forms of cultural exchange with aspects of both assimilation and resistance. In this regard, the phenomenon of cultural contact and translation is a give and take, with elements and meanings accepted, rejected, and others still transformed, dependent upon the new context and the motivations of the patrons, the artists, and the larger communities. I would propose then that we consider the Moldavian corpus as the product of its particular historical moment and its development in light of cultural interactions between Moldavia and its closer and more distant neighbors. In fact, the Moldavian cultural plurality, primarily facilitated through objects and people traveling from disparate places, resembles the eclecticism embraced in the artistic spheres in Venice, Cyprus, Crete, and Moscow, for example, as well as regions like Georgia and Armenia, all prominent centers that too forge certain connections with the Byzantine world and with the cultures of Western Europe, as well as others at various moments throughout their histories. When Peter Radish took the throne of the Principality on January 20th, 1527, he initially concerned himself with political and military matters, just like his father Stephen before him. However, the failed Ottoman siege of Vienna in 1529 seems to have given hope to Christian leaders and their subjects, the Moldavians included, that perhaps the Ottomans could, after all, be defeated and pushed back from Europe. These newly kindled hopes and ambitions also carried various political, military, cultural, and artistic ramifications. I propose that in the context of these epochal events, Peter's artistic and architectural patronage should be considered. It is precisely at this moment that the distinctive architecture and the expansive interior and especially exterior mural cycles on the Moldavian churches took form. With these initiatives, Peter not only continued and enhanced his father's ecclesiastical projects, but also left his own mark on the Moldavian corpus and the newly formed sacred landscape of the region. The reigns of Stephen and Peter witnessed the initiation and realization of extensive building projects in both the secular and ecclesiastical spheres, particularly of church architecture and its mural decoration. This tradition of architectural patronage was continued by the princes who succeeded them, though these later enterprises were never as numerous. And it was not until the last decades of the 16th century that another independent monastic church was built in Moldavia under princely patronage. And that is the Church of the Resurrection, a Suchavica monastery. This was the project of three brothers belonging to the Movila family, Jeremiah, Simon, and George. Suchavica was the last ecclesiastical monument in Moldavia, constructed and decorated in the fashion popularized by Stephen and further developed under Peter. Yet it also introduced a number of iconographic and architectural changes that will persist in Moldavian church architecture well into the 17th century. Moreover, the Church of Suchavica was the last Moldavian church to receive extensive painted, figurative images on its exterior walls, executed by a local workshop. That the mother of the Movila brothers was a descendant from Peter Radish's family line may explain why the founders of Suchavica erected a monastic church that emulated the ecclesiastical building and decorating traditions established under their princely predecessors. Suchavica thus functioned as an expression of legitimacy and social prestige for the Movila family and celebrated the accomplishments of their predecessors. This project, moreover, set in motion a new artistic revival in Moldavia that was to culminate in the first decades of the 17th century under the leadership of Vasile Lupu with the Church of the Three Hierarchs in Iași. And as you can clearly see here, we no longer have a building that's completely enveloped in painted figural decorations, but rather non-figural sculpted works. And supposedly, according to contemporary sources, these sculptures were also gilded. So you can imagine the impression that this building offered. Scholars to date have studied the ecclesiastical art and architecture of Moldavia largely from specific, somewhat limiting angles. As might be anticipated, Romanian archaeologists and historians, archaeologists and conservators have contributed to the greater part of the research on this material, and they have focused predominantly on formal, archaeological, and iconographic studies. Through their efforts, a great deal has been revealed about the forms of the buildings, the details of the complex iconographies discovered in the mural programs, as well as patronage. Relatively few have attempted to embed the structures in their larger historical contexts, to engage in detailed comparative work, or to consider the imagery in relation to liturgy, for example. The medieval artistic production of Moldavia and of Eastern Europe has certainly not been at the forefront of art historical scholarship. In part, inconsistencies in the definition of what constitutes Eastern Europe, or Central Europe, or East Central Europe, or Southeastern Europe, at any given moment have been responsible for the marginalization. To a large degree, the limited approaches have also been a consequence of 20th century politics. The Iron Curtain created actual and ideological barriers, rendering much of the relevant literature inaccessible and new fieldwork difficult to carry out. As a result, both the local and the international intellectual communities lacked access to the resources necessary to examine more fully and seriously the artistic production of Eastern Europe. Excuse me. In engaging with the architecture, image programs, and functions of the Moldavian churches in the context of religious politics and patronage, the Orthodox liturgy, the cult of saints, and the theory of images, I analyze in my work the extent to which these churches aided in the construction of a new sacred landscape in Moldavia at this crucial moment, while presenting visual responses and commentaries to a series of crises located in the past, present, and future, anticipated in the future. That is the events of 1453, the declared end of the world in 1492 as predicted by some Eastern Orthodox Christians corresponding to the year 7000 in the Byzantine calendar, and the failed Ottoman siege of Vienna in 1529, in the aftermath of which the Moldavian churches received their extensive murals. To this list, I would also add the spread of the Reformation, to which the vast Christological and Mariological iconographies on the Moldavian churches may have served as a response. My work also bridges the gap between Romanian, Slavic, German, Italian, and French scholarship on the topic, while engaging with notions of history, cultural memory, artistic integration, spatiotemporal experiences, as well as modes of cross-cultural rapport and translation. A more expansive and thorough examination of the Moldavian corpus and of medieval art in Eastern Europe could help encourage a rethinking of standard art historical narratives. Rigid and reinforced Western canons of rationality remain prevalent in scholarship, and also how this material is taught. And the current stories of the development of medieval, early modern, Byzantine, and post-Byzantine art continue to exclude the artistic production of Eastern Europe more broadly. A reevaluation of these issues involves, too, a scrutiny of existing periodizations, since I would say medieval artistic forms were produced in Moldavia and other Eastern European centers well into the 18th century. Art history as a discipline, as Robert Nelson wrote, quote, acquired and has been accorded the ability and power to control and judge its borders, to admit or reject people and objects, and teach and thus transmit values to others, end quote. An awareness of this issue and the problems it poses marks an initial step towards change. Amends are certainly beginning to happen, especially in recent decades, as the academic community more broadly, and art historians and medievalists in particular, are becoming increasingly aware of diverse voices and perspectives, and are asking more thoughtful questions of the objects, monuments, and built environments under consideration. The idea and the execution of the idea both matter, but perhaps what matters is also the timing of it all. The current global turn in medieval studies and art history is, in my opinion, the perfect moment to move beyond traditional boundaries in art historical scholarship and begin to chart how cross-cultural interactions contributed to diversity, shaped notions of identity, and yielded eclectic visual cultures in regions that truly developed at the crossroads of different traditions, among them Latin, Greek, Slavic, and Islamic, as is the case for the Eastern European material at the core of my work. And I want to just take a brief concluding point here to say that in the context of these efforts to expand the global, the temporal and geographic parameters of the study of medieval and Byzantine, post-Byzantine, and early modern art history, I co-founded the North of Byzantium Initiative. I also serve as an assistant editor for the Encyclopedia of the Global Middle Ages. And just this Wednesday launched the Mapping Eastern Europe project, which we can return to in the conversation. The Moldavian corpus of ecclesiastical monuments presents a fascinating study, and together with the rest of the artistic production of Eastern Europe, might allow us to begin to expand the geographic and temporal parameters and also mend some of the divides within the study of medieval and Byzantine art, while engaging in nuanced conversations about cultural contacts, the roles of patrons and artists, and religious communities, among other topics. Historians of art certainly face choices of knowledge and alternatives that may entail loss, to return now to Georges Didier Huberman's remarks from the opening of this presentation. But the proposal is not for an alternative. Rather, it is for an openness to explore new territory and move beyond traditional narratives, because what lies beyond may help us reveal more nuanced facets of the stories of both Western medieval, Byzantine, and early modern art history and culture, in which art history as a discipline has been more firmly grounded. And on that note, I thank you for your attention.